The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day one of this January 2017 seven-day sesshin here at Hidden Valley Zen Center in Southern California on a rather curious period of weather. Lots of rain, the sun comes out, the sun goes back, the sun comes out, the sun goes back. Right now it happens to be out. How similar to the workings of our mind. As most of you know, Leonard Cohen, the Buddhist songwriter, he happened to be a songwriter and he also happened to be a Buddhist. Not that he wrote Buddhist songs, but he was a student of Josu Sasaki and just recently died. And one of the quotes from one of his songs, which were usually quite perceptive, is as follows. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. In the West, at least certainly the Western United States, our child-rearing tactics are such that, and I think the beliefs of Christianity have added to this, this concept of original sin, we feel we are flawed. This is a big thing. Apparently it was also prevalent in India in the time of the Buddha, because when he was enticed by Mara, attempting to take him away from his deepening practice in that first ever sesshin, during which he gradually explored the workings of his own mind. Mara first tried enticement, brought out his dancing daughters, his beautiful daughters, to sway and dance and do a sort of a come hither thing to the Buddha, but he ignored it. He had more important, more pressing things that were on his mind. And that didn't work, so Mara pulled out the pain as expressed by his hordes of demons shooting lances into the Buddha, pouring hot mud on him. And of course, anyone who sat a sesshin for a while has experienced some level of that, usually. Only we don't think of it as boiling mud or spears and lances. We think of it as, though, the damn knee pain, the back pain, so on and so forth. Well, that didn't work either. So Mara pulled out his final straw. You don't have what it takes. You're not worthy. You got cracks in you, bud. And the Buddha put his hand down, touched the earth, to call the earth to witness that he was truly worthy. And on the eighth morning, after his seven nights and 8 days of deepening practice, deepening insight, deepening exploration of his own mind, he is said to have said, "Wonder of wonders, all beings are perfect, whole and complete, lacking nothing. But because the minds of men and women are turned upside down through delusive thinking, they failed to perceive this." And delusive thinking it is. We've been taught in various overt and more subtle ways that we're not worthy. And yet, this is an opportunity This is where the light can come in. What is practice in a nutshell? It is the exploration of our own mind. Without it, how can we know whether this idea of unworthiness, whether this image that we have of ourselves, garnered from however long, of conditioning, of experiences, of conclusions drawn by those experiences. We have a negative experience, somebody is nasty to us, and there are a number of reactions we may have. We may just simply get angry, not believing it, or we may, as the saying goes, taking personally, assume there's something wrong with us, and that's why whatever is going on is going on. We may have made a mistake, we may have stepped on somebody's toes, but that has nothing to do with whether or not we're worthy. And this is something very different in the core of Buddhism, this assumption of innate perfection. We're filled with compassion and wisdom, and it is only because we don't recognize the truth of who and what we are that we fail to act on it 100% of the time. I'd like to share with you something from a new book that's come out, a translation of the teachings by the Dalai Lama, The Heart of Meditation. The Heart of Meditation. Discovering Innermost Awareness. The Dalai Lama is a practitioner of a particular form of the Tibetan style of Buddhism known as Dzogchen. Dzogchen is essentially quite similar to Zen. It's about exploring our own mind. And that's what we do. When we extend the out-breath, when we stay fully present with that experience of breathing out and breathing that breath out as long as we can without gasping, it lets go necessarily other involvements, and this is its gift. It forces us, in a way, to focus on the physical experience of breathing out. And in that focus on the physical experience of breathing out, we have to let go ideas, thoughts, assumptions, conditioning. We may run into some evidence of it as captured in our body. For some people, particularly in the earlier stages of practice, and particularly if they've experienced some level of abuse in their childhood, the breath only comes out so far, and they can't get it further out. Well, what to do about that? Tune in. Tune in. Modern psychology has just begun, relatively recently, within the last several decades, to discover something that the psychologist, who was at the time a graduate student, Eugene Gendlin, in Chicago, working on a question of what made people either progress fastly in psychotherapy or stay churning the wheels for decades. He termed it the felt sense. It was very quickly discovered on looking at videos of therapy sessions and so on that those people who were able to tune in to their body. This is different from tuning into your thought. Tuning into your body, getting a sense of what's really going on in there. These people were able to move beyond being captured by their history. And it is the same thing for us in Zen practice. As we bring that breath out, and that is the fundamental practice here. Of course, if you're working on a koan, you're still working on that out-breath. And you're using the koan, curiosity, perplexity, to fuel that out-breath, to bring it further and further out, as if you're reaching through the out-breath for the answer. It may be the answer to the koan. If you're not working on the koan, it's an opening. As you get further out with this out-breath, paying utter attention to the physical experience of it, letting go other concerns, and this is the beauty of extending it. When we simply follow the breath, we don't get that benefit. It's more of an effort to stay present. But as we extend that out-breath, we have to focus. We have to pay attention. It's something that most people don't do a lot of these days. We're so tied up with our electronic toys. Just recently I saw a mother with a small child, very small child, probably not old enough to walk, in a grocery basket. And the mother was going around shopping at the store that I was at, and this child kept reaching out to the mother who was shopping like this. Yes, yes. Now behave yourself. There's a great concern among the psychology community that we're raising a generation of children who are not able to get imprinted in the way it is healthy to do so, to become normal, healthy, caring human beings. Because mom and dad often both have their faces in their little toys and don't interact with the child in ways and sufficiently enough that will help that child develop and grow into a fully human being. This is of great concern, but that's not what our Teishuo is about today. As we extend the out-breath, reaching, searching, we can find ourselves on the threshold of something big. It's as if we stepped into a doorway. It's not awakening yet, but it's on the threshold, moving towards it. How does it come about? Over and over again, we extend that out-breath, reaching, searching, open to opportunity, open to possibility. And through that process, we are able to reach a point where we're not thinking, where there's a gap between thoughts. And that gap between thoughts, where we are so fully present that there's nothing going on in our head, is that threshold. It can come first as a tiny little blip that suddenly flips through our consciousness. But as that happens, try to pay more attention, try to catch it, and stay present with that moment. You'll find yourself backing out unwittingly, not realizing it, but you'll know it when things suddenly become two-dimensional, whereas they were three-dimensional on that threshold. It's a very different experience to be at the threshold. And it's our normal way of consciousness, where we're not multitasking, quote, paying attention and also thinking, ruminating, or playing with our toys, or remembering the past, or projecting into the future, or anything but staying present. It's not so easy for modern Westerners to truly stay present because we are so conditioned not to do so. And of course, if we've had difficult experiences as children and become conditioned to that, or if we've been taught in very strict ways that demand of us that we have a very narrow expression of ourselves, we live in a very tight mind space often floating above life because we dare not feel, because we've taught that certain kinds of things that we feel are not appreciated by the grown-ups in our lives, or that worse, we may get punished for it, or we may have experiences as children that were terrifying or painful. And these are not necessarily abusive experiences. A child having his tonsils out can feel traumatized by the experience in the hospital. I remember when we returned to the United States after living in Burma, and it was very clear that both my sons needed to have their tonsils out. They had multiple infections, ear infections, and so on. In fact, my older son actually had to have a mastoidectomy when we were living in Burma, which is very unusual, and most doctors don't believe it until they see the scar, because he experienced a drug-resistant ear infection. So we took both the boys, they were aged 3 and 5 at the time, to the hospital for their pre-op, during which they were going to have the blood drawn. And I thought, well, Randy, the older one, is older and he will be less impacted by, you know, having a needle put up his arm to get the blood out. So we had the younger one do it first. The younger one actually turns out to be much more able to deal with those kinds of things. And when I saw the look of horror on Randy's face when he watched Greg's blood drain being drawn, I realized that it probably would have been better if we'd done it the other direction. Children can be traumatized by all kinds of things, including a bad accident, falling off their bike and smashing their face, that kind of thing. It's not necessarily a physical or sexual abuse, but physical and sexual abuse also add into that as well if the child is unfortunate enough to have experienced that. And so we have all these things in our background, in our history. It's rare that a human being grows up without some level of conditioning. At the very least, our first smile, when our facial muscles and nerves have managed to coordinate to the point where we can smile as an infant in the first few weeks of life, and the response of the adults around us makes all the difference in the world. The very beginning of conditioning begins before that. I have a student back east whose mother turns out to have been schizophrenic, and the first few months of her life she was embraced, nurtured, and then her mother went somewhere else in her own mind, and the child was left abandoned basically until eventually another relative stepped in. But that period of months where the child was not fed, not nurtured, not cared for in the ordinary way one expects to take care of a child, were traumatic, and understandably so. And that trauma has come up in that person's Zen practice. She's working with an excellent therapist and beginning to make a lot of headway in working through these kinds of things. Most of us, thankfully, have not had that level of experience, but that conditioning starts very young. And then we go to school. There's a study been done quite a long time ago where they filmed mothers and children the first day of school of a child, and the child is going off to kindergarten and turns around, checks out the mom. What's the mom's reaction to this experience? And when the mothers are excited and happy and this is a wonderful opportunity feeling, the child marches in and engages in the classroom and gets a wonderful start in the school. But if mom is anxious and afraid, it's going to miss their child so much. then the child picks up on that as well, because we communicate wordlessly among each other. Just walk into a room where somebody's angry and you get it. You know somebody's angry, you can feel it. Or walk into a room where somebody's sad, and the same thing. And so gradually we're imprinted. We get this idea, this big image of who we are. And then we're compelled to act, to preserve it, to protect it, to uphold it, to reinforce it. And that is the basis of suffering. When we assume someone's insulting us, and they may or may not be, because we perceive the world through the lens of our conditioning. And if we've been abused, maltreated, we're going to see that where it may not exist. So, what about this innate perfection? Who are we really? If we are so perfect, why don't we act that way? Why don't we grow up loved, nurtured? Well, that depends on who we chose and what our karma is coming into this life. Doing the practice. As we stand on that threshold of total presence, having reached a point where we can open to a gap between thoughts, a gap between the storyline, here we have a wonderful opportunity to tune in, to expand our experience of that, to explore that wordless, you don't know what to call it, and it's better not to call it something anyway. As you go more and more deeply into this, eventually you come to an understanding, at least a superficial understanding, of the true nature of reality. But that's only the beginning. Tore Enji, Hawkwind's first Dharma successor, only in his 20s. He was so deeply committed to practice. And somewhere along the way, when he was about 26, he got deathly ill. The doctors gave up on him, and he decided, by then he'd already had a deep awakening experience. He decided that if he was going to die, he would just go for it and rest, take care of his body in the last remaining days or weeks or months that he had. And during that time, as he was able, he would write down what he understood about Zen practice. And this is coming from someone who had already done very deep Zen practice from very long time. By the time he was 26, he'd done more than a decade of serious practice. And that treatise, he called it, he did recover, and he sent it to Hawkwind, and Hawkwind took a look. Tore had said, if this has got anything to offer to anybody, then do it with it what you will. If not, please burn it. And obviously, Hawkwind felt it was optimal to keep it in print. And so we have a translation, actually we have two translations, one of which unfortunately is extremely expensive because it's out of print. The currently in print one was translated by one of the Cleary brothers, a treatise on the inexhaustible lamp. A treatise on the inexhaustible lamp. The other one that's so out of print was translated in part by Myokyo Ni, the German woman who was a Dharma successor on the Rinzai sect, and had taught at the Zen Center in London. I don't think she's alive anymore, but she translated with the help of a Japanese student. She had lived and trained at, I think it was Nanzenji in Japan, for many years. And this is deep Rinzai training. She was, as we say, the real deal. And she was able to, because her teacher at the time suggested that she read a commentary by a then contemporary Japanese master on that treatise. Both of them are translated in this much thicker book. And if you can at all get hold of that one, do so. Unfortunately, at the moment, I think the going price is somewhere around $400. But if there's any possibility, hopefully someday it will get reprinted, because it's extremely helpful to have that commentary, which is published side by side with the actual treatise. In it, Tora Inji talks about the different levels of practice, how essential it is to do what he calls the advanced practice, which is the practice, the post-kensho practice. Now, it needs to be said as well that, unlike what the Kepler Rishi sort of thought when he first went to Japan to train in Zen, having taken some courses from D.T. Suzuki at Columbia University, and as he put it, his fellow students sort of said, put up or shut up, because apparently he talked a lot about Zen. And so he went, he burned all his bridges and went to train first with Nakagawa Soen Rishi, who then took him after 3 months up to Hoshinji to train with his major teacher, Daien Sogaku Harada Rishi. And Kepler Rishi's intention going to Japan was to, as he put it, get Kensho and run. Grab Kensho and run, I think he said it specifically. But that's not how it really goes in real practice. And he thankfully didn't do that. He stuck it out after Kensho and continued to practice deeply. And in my experience with him, as I trained with him through his entire decades of training and was his attendant a number of times, one of the things that impressed me is most about him was that he continued to practice. He continued to work on himself. And this is what Tore Enji called the long maturation. So we work to pass that initial breakthrough koan. And we don't stop there. We continue to open and deepen and hopefully have more Kensho experiences through the work on, he called the advanced practice, the work on the subsequent koans. And all along the way, and this can begin from the moment we start practice or even before, if we have some sense of it, there is something he called the long maturation, which is equally vital, because we can have the most incredible Kensho experience, deep Satori experience in the world. But if we can't live it, if our behavior is still dysfunctional, caught in greed, anger, and delusion, as it was before, that Kensho, that Satori is worthless. Because, in fact, it may be more than worthless because it may have given us some idea of superiority. A true Kensho brings us to realize what? But as a result of the realization, we don't have to be self-important. We don't have to be somebody who rates. We can take criticism. We can take disappointment and let it go and move on. Not be caught in it. But this is not where we get initially. And this is why ongoing practice is so vital. The Dalai Lama, in this talk that is translated as The Heart of Meditation, Discovering Innermost Awareness, says a couple of things, and they're relevant to us here. In the introduction, in the foreword, the translator says, "In this book, I've interwoven these private teachings with the Dalai Lama's seminar lectures in Camden Center," this was in England, "which affords readers a compelling picture about how to put themselves into a deep state beyond the confining coverings of too much thought, released into the naked core of innermost mind." Released into the naked core of this innermost mind, standing on that threshold between thoughts is the beginning of the entrance to that. Later on, "Since it is the individual person who undergoes pleasure and pain, makes trouble and accumulates karma, all the noise and the mess being made by the self," this small image of self, analysis should begin with yourself. "Then when you've understood that you yourself are without this overblown status, you can extend the realization to the things that you enjoy, undergo, and make use of. In this sense, the person is the principal subject of analysis." Now, analysis, this quote analysis, is not a thinking analysis. This is opening to that space between thought, tuning in as the great people who have discovered things in this world have done. "Can you remember a time when you did something awful and your mind thought, I really made a mess of things? Or worse, you could have thought something like, oh God, I'll catch hell now. How can I escape? Let me get out of here. At that moment, your sense of I appears to have its own concrete entity, which is neither mind nor body, but something that appears much more strongly, does it not? Or remember a time when you did something wonderful or something really nice happened to you, and you took great pride in it. This I that was so valued, so cherished, so liked, and was the object of such self-importance was so concretely and vividly clear. At such times, your sense of I is particularly obvious. Once you catch hold of such a blatant manifestation of I, you can cause this strong sense of I to appear to your mind, and without letting the way it seems diminish in strength, you can examine, as if from a corner, whether it actually exists in the solid way it appears." When we experience life, something happens, and particularly if it's a negative something that happens, we usually try to get rid of it, deny it, rise above it, go into some different mind state, and it's often called dissociation, where we deny that it happened. But if instead we go right into the physical experience of this mind state, sink down, and as the Dalai Lama said, examine it as if from a corner. That is, tune in. Don't think about it. Don't analyze it with words, but tune in. Stay present with that physical experience until it dissolves, because it eventually will if you do stay totally present with it. And even though there may not be any overt insight in that moment, something's cooking underneath. Transformation begins. Keep it up. This is also part of our practice. It's not a part of our practice that we normally assume. We always think when we come in as Zen practice that we have to get somewhere into this ideal mind state. No. It's about where we are in each moment, but tuning in, feeling it, experiencing it bodily. In this way, and particularly if we're open to possibility, our practice will naturally deepen by itself. The extended out-breath is a miracle worker. Give it everything you've got. You've just had a map of practice. The rest is up to you. I thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.